This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Isn't it equal?
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with the show's producer, Kerry Jr. II.
Yes, here in the flesh.
Another great week of shows here on Created Equal. And I want to start by talking about one that got a lot of attention from people I know. I was getting texts about it, and I saw it all over social. It happened to be a show that we were re-airing this week.
Right.
We had done it in December. It was about the new People's Food Co-op that's opening on Woodward. I'm about as excited about that as anybody. And my friend Malik Yakini, who has been working on that for more than a decade, I think it's like 12 or 13 years. It is about what it means to food security and
ownership.
And ownership in the city. And it's a huge step forward. So that's one of the episodes that that we're going to hear a little bit of about today. Another is about the state budget. Now I'm going to make
this
people's eyes
document
glaze over a little bit. I'm talking about nerdy stuff again. The governor's budget proposal, which I think makes a number of very bold moral statements about how we spend money as people in Michigan, how we spend that money to help people who need it, and how we spend money to move people to opportunities. Mm. Monique Stanton, who's the president and CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy, which is a nonprofit group that analyzes budgets and legislation for their effect on people and especially poor people and their lives. I wanted to have a conversation with Monique about what she thought about this budget.
Yeah, Monique was a really good conversation. I think, without too much, give too much away, I think she made a good point about being consistent when you're the governor across different administrations. So it was really enlightening for me to hear some of that, and looking forward to sharing that with the listeners as well.
Yeah. And then our last segment today is with Luke Schaefer, who is the
familiar name,
director of Poverty Solutions at the University of Michigan, the co-author of a recent book that is about place and poverty and how it is shaped by place here in America. The idea that where you live, where you're born, determines in so many ways what your opportunities look like. And this research that they did led them to some really, I think, new and somewhat stunning conclusions about the nature of rural poverty, which is really interesting because we live in Detroit, where we see daily the examples of how urban poverty affects people's lives. We don't think about the parallels even between that and people who live in rural Kentucky or the border section of Texas or some of the other places they went. We're going to start today with Luke Schaefer of Poverty Solutions at the University of Michigan. So, Luke, when we think about these rural communities in different places, all that find themselves trapped in this cyclical poverty. And you go and you discover that history has a lot to do with why they're in the situation that they're in. Industry has a lot to do with the situation that they're in. It seems to me that in some ways this is an observation of the shortcomings of capitalism as it's been practiced in this country. So why are these places different from other places that capitalism has had maybe the same effect but not to the same degree? And why can't they get past what happened to them before? And I don't mean that in an accusatory way about the people who live there, but why can't we solve for these deep problems?
I do
think this is a very small question. I'm sure it'll take you 2 minutes to answer, right?
All right, 2 minutes. I do think that this is a story, obviously, about capitalism in its most extractive form.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about industries that do violence to the very, you know, places where they are, not just the people, but the physical places. Cotton is rough on the soil, and coal, obviously. And then that it requires this large labor force is the most damning thing, mm-hmm. of basically enforcing a sub-citizenship on a set of people in order for it to be practiced the way it is.
Yeah.
And another thing that we are try to be clear about in the book is that these are industries that don't just impact these regions themselves, but really are fundamental to the industrialization of the whole country.
Yes.
That and even the world, right? As cotton that's picked by enslaved people and tenant farmers in the South, you know, financed by northern banks, spreads across the country and then actually goes overseas, right, to textile mills mm-hmm. in the United Kingdom. Tobacco, you know, coal is really driving a lot of this industrialization. And so we're all complicit, I think, in that.
Yeah.
You know, I tend to think of I'm aware of a lot of the benefits of capitalism as well. Mm-hmm. That you know, overall, it has raised living standards over the last 100 plus years with the costs. But I think anything taken in its most extreme form, yeah. right? And in this case, it's incredibly extreme, does violence to the place and does violence to the people. And the fallout of that just sets in almost a path dependency, I think, sort of a trajectory that is maybe not impossible to get out of, but incredibly, incredibly hard for communities.
Yeah. I mean, it is really interesting to think about coal, tobacco, cotton, and agriculture, and how they are really different capitalist forces in the 20th century, especially than they had been, and that there's this flip side to all they create for us.
Yeah,
it's all that they take from some people in order to do it.
Yep.
But that leads me back to Detroit because mm-hmm. we are such an important piece of that 20th century. Growth and an explosion of industry. Certainly, you can find parallels between places in Southeast Michigan and some of these other places. Yeah. But overall, we're not quite in the same position. Is that the difference between rural communities and cities, or is there something else going on?
Yeah. So when you sort of try to build theory as a social scientist, you explore patterns in a place and then see how they can be applied in others. And in Michigan, I think it's a place that can almost confirm or lend support. So of those 100 most disadvantaged places that we study, 90+% of them are rural. But Detroit and Flint are also
into the category because of the
And then Cleveland mm-hmm. And some other sort of Rust Belt cities. And so you're right in that Detroit didn't quite follow the model as extreme and extractive, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. there is this move as all of our eggs get put into the auto basket to build working class jobs, right? That actually fuels a lot of migration from the Cotton Belt, but also Appalachia. Yes. So there's a huge, great migration from Appalachia mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. That builds up an industry that creates a tremendous amount of wealth. A lot of it goes to the top, but on average, more goes to those sort of closer to the bottom.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, we continue to be an incredibly segregated city, right? So the social order of segregation gets enforced in Detroit.
Yeah.
And then as that industry, I think those forces lead to sort of the collapse of the city. And then the industry decline follows a similar pattern to all of these places. Yeah. And we have a we have a chapter in the book called Revolt and Retribution, mm-hmm. which is about how in each one of these places, at some point, the have-nots rise up. And they say, we're not going to take it anymore. And there's some really incredible stories and big wins in that. And also, there's always retribution. Yeah. There's always a price to be paid. And sometimes it's violence, and sometimes it's people moving out. And then sort of a concerted effort to, as a city comes to be controlled by the have-nots, to make sure it fails, yeah. right, in the broader region. And I think you can see some parallels there, too.
Yeah, yeah. So I also want to talk about isolation and the role physical isolation plays in perpetuating this kind of poverty. And I bring that up specifically from my own experience in Eastern Kentucky.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up in Detroit and was used to seeing a certain kind of poverty. The physical isolation in Eastern Kentucky is unimaginable, I think, to someone who grew up in a city.
Yeah.
How hard it is to get from wherever you are to any place else, but especially to something better, right?
Yeah.
The idea of mobility being tied to opportunity is one of the things that really holds them back. And I imagine that that is a rural commonality in these other places as well.
Yeah, the scale, the density is a challenge. And so there's a good amount of literature that finds like social services, nonprofit services, community organizations tend to be clustered in urban areas because mm-hmm. that's where you can impact more
people
folks,
are.
Right?
Yeah.
And in rural communities, much less so. And in fact, many of our federal programs that you might apply for to bring resources on this stuff into your community, they're almost stacked towards being able to go to urban areas mm-hmm. and not these rural areas. And in many more ways than just a really important one, which is that you need good grant writers to do those things, and there's fewer of those in rural communities. So mm-hmm. when we were in Manchester in Clay County in Kentucky, we started talking to families. And, of course, the opioid epidemic is really on people's minds.
Yes.
And we think of that actually as the most recent extractive industry. That region was really targeted by pharmaceuticals going mm-hmm. in as being susceptible. And you saw the growth there and disproportionate harm done for an industry that is like preying really on the bodies of people.
Yes, yes. And has been doing it to that region for a long time,
far before
the opioid crisis. When I was living in Eastern Kentucky, we used to call what people were taking, we called them nerve pills. They called them nerve pills.
Yeah, that's
right. Kind of a pre-opioid kind of escapism. But you would go to people's homes and they would have a candy dish on the coffee table.
Yeah.
With these
there's
pills.
A history of this going back, again, more than 100 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So we would talk to families about, if things got better in your community, what would it look like?
Mm-hmm.
And time and time again, people would say, kids get into drugs because there's nothing else to do, nothing to do but drugs. We want more stuff for the kids to be able to do. And at first, honestly, we didn't take that seriously. It sounds sort of like, how could that have explain
right?
this like huge, complex problem. But once we heard it over and over again, you really start to have to look at it. And this research on the impacts of social isolation and the positive impacts of these, we use the word social infrastructure. These are like the places where people can come together mm-hmm. as much as possible across differences and build social connections and have cheap fun, if you will.
Yeah,
One of them is like the arcade.
Mm-hmm.
So arcades are like surprisingly good places for people to go and meet people and have fun with others. And you think about replacing the arcade with somebody playing video games and by themselves in
their
living room.
Right, yeah. Wow.
So we talked to Angus Deaton about this. He's a Nobel laureate in economics who wrote a book about the opioid crisis, and he said, I don't just think it's a real issue. It's like one of the most important issues. Mm-hmm. And he sent us to some research. One of my favorite studies is about lab rats. Mm-hmm. So it's, I'm going to compare people to lab rats. I'm sorry about that. But if you expose an isolated lab rat to drugs, they will often get addicted and they will often overdose. But if that cute little lab rat has other cute lab rat friends and fun stuff to do in a cage, they will only use the drugs recreationally. They will very rarely overdose and never die.
Huh. And Angus, so it is about contact and socialization.
Yeah. So all of this research finds like having a great conversation like triggers things like similarly to drugs.
To drugs.
And so we're sort of replacing some of that like brain activity with drugs.
Yeah.
Just one more quick piece of research. So Angus led us to this research on Vietnam vets. So it turns out American soldiers in Vietnam used drugs in mass quantities mm-hmm. while they were there. Mm-hmm. And Nixon was really concerned about this. And so he commissioned a very rigorous study and found, asked soldiers, why do you do drugs? And they said, when we're not out, there's right, nothing else to do.
What else is there?
Yeah, and, drugs are cheap, so that was another piece. But, huge amount of drug use, often, like, at levels that we would consider highly addicted. Mm-hmm. And when they return to the United States into well-structured lives with jobs and families, they stopped using drugs at, like, levels that most of our models suggest would be impossible.
Wow. But, again, that socialization was... What drove that?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Having this sort of connections, having structure to our lives and the connections with other people, we think can really drive it. So, opioids and overdose continue to be an incredibly complicated issue. But what if building splash parks is a part of the answer where people can make connections or local movie theaters? And so that's part of what this book tries to do is give us a chance to look at hard issues and in from new vantage points.
Yeah. I also, of course, want to talk about race. These four communities are diverse in the sense that they're not all majority African-American. You have two that are.
Yeah.
But there's a white community and there's a community that is largely Latino. What does this tell us about what we know about the role that race plays in opportunity and economics and the history of discrimination, which wouldn't explain, for instance, Appalachia as well as it does the Cotton Belt or the Tobacco Belt?
Yeah, we want to link the story of these places together, but at the same time, I think it's important to recognize that it takes its most brutal and most exploitative form in the Cotton Belt and the Tobacco Belt.
Because of race.
Because of race. Enslavement and then tenant farming is just many orders of magnitude more brutal and exploitative than what we see in any of the other places. Mm-hmm. But I think in also trying to link it to this broader pattern of what's going on in the other places, it can give us more insights into the story behind it. So the story that we are telling about race starts as an economic story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in that we take a similar view as Ida B. Wells, right, who really understood and, so many of her writings identify that physical violence, right, state-sponsored violence against Black Americans was at its heart one of sort of economic supremacy.
Yes.
And so all of the social issues get sort of wrapped around it, but that's the fundamental piece.
Yeah, designed to keep people poor.
Designed to keep people poor. Yeah, some people poor and some people rich or, higher income to reinforce that economic order. And then everything else gets layered on top of it. One of the interesting things about South Texas is that it ends up being some of the same players as it is in the Cotton Belt. So some of the families who are running plantations as cotton starts to run out of the soil. Basically, it gets harder and harder. They actually pick up and move to South Texas as they figure out irrigation. And there's this sort of steady supply of folks who are coming across the border.
Yeah.
And they create a whole nother structure, which is not as brutal and as, but is built on the same principles of reinforcing the sort of sub-citizenship. Yeah. So the migratory farm pattern of, South Texas up into the Midwest and then through Michigan for cherries,
sure.
And then back down, there would be all the primary elections would be done, while farmers are not in the community. They're trying to reinforce that social order. And in some cases, you have this documentation where they say they're actually learning from their experiences in the Cotton Belt to sort of create this new system on top of them. So they are directly linked.
Right. That was Luke Schaefer, who runs Poverty Solutions at the University of Michigan, talking about his new book about rural poverty. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
We're back with more Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. Let's go now to my conversation this week with Monique Stanton, the president and CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy, about the priorities that are evident in Governor Gretchen Whitmer's 2024-25 budget proposal. Monique Stanton, welcome to Created Equal.
Good morning.
Yeah, it's
thanks
great
for
to
having
have
me,
you
Stephen.
Here. Yeah, so I wanted to talk to you in particular about this subject, about the governor's proposed budget, because I always go back to this description of budgeting that I once heard, which is that budgets are moral documents. Mm-hmm. It's not just about dollars and cents. It's not just about balancing things. It really is about a statement about priorities and the things that we value. And I know that the Michigan League for Public Policy, that's how you guys think about budgeting. It also occurs to me that if we think about the way Governor Gretchen Whitmer has approached budgeting since she was elected, she's been moving closer and closer to this idea of a budget that is framed almost entirely from the perspective of the priorities that we want to assign to government's effect on people's lives, I guess is the way I would describe that. And I think this is something that most people who live in the state probably don't see when the rest of us who work in the press or in policy work are obsessing over every line in the budget. But it's important, and it's important for them to understand what's going on here and why it matters. And I think that you are kind of the perfect vessel for that conversation. So I want to start with you telling me about what the governor is proposing in her budget and why it's important that she's making the shifts that she is, and the things that kind of jump out to you that tell you that she's moving in that direction.
Great. Thanks, Stephen. We really at the League believe that the budget is a moral document, like you said, and what we choose to spend money on or don't frankly spend money on is a testament to what we believe is important and who we value in our community. And the governor's budget, it's an $80 billion budget. That's a lot of money and resources.
Yes.
But really taking a look at it through an economic and racial justice lens, there are huge investments that we're building on, from the federal investments that started during COVID to making sure that we have some ongoing, continuing funding to support really important things. Things like continuation of free school breakfasts and lunches. Mm-hmm. That's important for kids, mm-hmm. especially as we've seen increases in the demand for hunger. Investments in the Opportunity Index and continuing the commitment that started last year to making sure that we have an equitable school funding formula and recognizing that kids with special needs or having high concentrations of poverty are getting some impact. Changes to our Family Independence Program or temporary assistance to needy families, raising the benefit level, that's another important thing that we're looking at doing in our state budget to address equity gaps.
Yeah. And let's talk for a minute about how we got here. Right. Governor Gretchen Whitmer was elected for the first time in 2018. Mm-hmm. So this is her, I'm going to count, this is the fifth or sixth budget.
Right.
It didn't start here.
Nope.
She has been moving that way. And in some cases, she's had to do it with a legislature that stood in opposition to
Absolutely.
Much of what she wanted to do. Talk about how she has brought us to this budget and this point.
So Governor Whitmer has had a significant commitment to racial equity and looking at things through a racial equity lens. And I think if you take a look at this budget, it really highlights that. But one of the things that happened during COVID was, I think, a light was shined on our social safety
mm-hmm.
and how we can use money, because poverty really is an absence of dollars and resources to prevent really significant crisis in families.
Yeah.
And we showed that work. Like if you look at the federal child tax credit, we cut poverty in half. So we know poverty is a choice. It's a policy choice. And we don't have to make those types of choices. And so I think the governor and her team really leaned in to lessons learned during the pandemic. And we really saw that there are things that we can do differently. And those commitments were made. And with the legislative makeup change, I think that she was able to help get some of her priorities across the finish line last year. And what we see this year really is a continuation and an enhancement of a lot of significant investments that started last year to make
yeah.
sure that we can have those things going forward.
Yeah. Some of the things that she's doing, of course, are boosted by the abundance of federal dollars that have come into Michigan, you know, because of COVID and then mm-hmm. because of some of the legislation that was passed by the Biden administration to help states out, getting out of COVID and going forward. But a lot of it is also about how we spend the dollars that we collect here in Michigan from Michiganders and redistribute them. And we've done that, of course, forever. Other governors have not taken this approach. And it's not just about, I guess the differences are not just about how the money is spent or where it's spent. I guess some of it is about the approach overall and the coordination, I guess, of dollars in that in some cases were in disparate places in federal or in state government and are now kind of being consolidated. It's not just about budgeting. It's also about the structure of our government here
right.
in Michigan that's changing.
Absolutely. So talk about structure issues. For local communities, governments, people, school districts, it's really hard when there are radical up and down changes. So you get an influx of money and then that money goes away. So if you're talking about hiring staff, creating programs that people can know that are reliable year after year, that's a big change, I think, with this governor's budget. So we started some really positive things during COVID, and she's been committed to continuing those forward, recognizing that these were successful programs,
mm-hmm.
and we need to keep making these types of investments. So that's a structural change. So things like we started free lunches. We're making a commitment that this is now a priority. The cost for that has gone up, but we want to see that service continues. The school funding, we've changed, you know, there's been changes with MDE and the Michigan MyLeap department. So there's structural changes there. But looking at that opportunity index funding, we started it last year and we're continuing it. We don't sort of see this expectation that you started one great investment in 1 year and you're expecting to see huge turnaround results in 1 year, recognizing that these things take time to really start to show some of the positive outcomes.
It also occurs to me that some of what she's doing, and this is to the point that you were just making, is not just about who's the governor at the time, right? I mean, and in Michigan, we've been pretty bad, I think, about the seesaw effect of state government. You know, a Democrat is in office for a while and does some things, and then a Republican gets elected and they spend their time undoing a lot of what was done, and then they go in a different direction. And we did see that with, you know, Engler to Granholm to Snyder. I think there's a very clear path. What she's doing, it seems, is not just saying, well, we're going to undo some of the things we didn't like from the administration before, but we're going to change the way that this all works so that, again, that there is predictability and stability.
Mm-hmm. Predictability is essential. So here's a good example of where that's working well is with Medicaid.
Uh-huh.
So under Snyder's administration, he, with the leadership, expanded Medicaid in Michigan as a result of the Affordable Care Act. That was a huge benefit to Michigan families.
Yes.
And what we've seen now in the governor's administration is how can we take that significant, important expansion and continue to make it better? So we're doing things like there's proposal to get rid of the Medicaid birth expense for, so if you have a baby, they will charge fathers if they're not wed to the mom mm-hmm. for those Medicaid expenses. So we're getting rid of that. That's an equity issue. We're getting rid of the $10 fee that families are charged for the My Child program. And so how can we make existing services better? And those things aren't necessarily always huge pots of money, but they make a big difference in people's lives. And so that continuation is really, really important. So we, again, getting away from that seesaw effect is essential.
Yeah. And then also when we're talking about this boon of federal dollars that has come in, I think a lot of people worry that, well, it is going to go away at some point. The federal government won't continue to subsidize a lot of the things that it has forever. I think a lot of people also worry about how we're prioritizing that money so that when it does run out, we are not caught short, right? That we're not creating things that we can't sustain. Or spending in a way that that doesn't give us long-term results. And she's really been, I think, thoughtful about the way we've approached that. There's some criticisms that people have made, but and some of them I think are legitimate. But overall, I think the approach has been to make changes that won't be dependent on that money.
Correct. And that's why I think you see in this year's budget specifically, you see some big, you know, big things that she's trying to do, but a lot of it is continuation because we did use those federal dollars for big one-time projects.
Yeah.
And that's going away. So we didn't create ongoing programs that were going to be dependent and sort of figure it out later, kick the can down the road. We didn't do that with this budget, which I think is really important.
Yeah. Yeah. When we you were talking just earlier about some of these things, some of these specific changes and how they are equity issues. Mm-hmm. I want to stop for a second and have you talk about why they are equity issues and why that approach matters. I feel like we're in a time when there's a lot of people who say that's not how we should be thinking about things, that that the progress that's been made, the social progress that's been made in this country puts us at a place where we shouldn't focus on that kind of opportunity. I want to have you make the case for why that makes sense.
Sure. So equity from our standpoint is not sameness. People need different things in order to be successful.
That's right.
And if you look at outcomes, whether it's, you know, yesterday was Women's Pay Equality Day. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a long time in the year in terms of how long it takes for men and women
to be paid equal.
And for Black and brown women and women of color, that's even a longer time period.
Sure.
And so there's outcomes there. There's maternal infant health outcomes, there's infant mortality outcomes, and things that we know that race plays an important factor and what those outcomes look like, as well as sort of economic opportunity. But race and economic and poverty are not necessarily interchangeable. And so we want to make sure that we're looking at what people need and addressing that in order to help level the playing field and help make sure that people have an opportunity to succeed. I think that Opportunity School Index is a perfect example. We talk about concentrations of poverty. There's a great map on the website that our website that shows, you know, what school districts or what counties have different percentages for that opportunity index. And it's telling, you know, I think, you know, over half of our school kids are going to benefit from that because we have issues with poverty in our state. And that's both in our cities and in deep rural community as well.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a fight in Lansing right now over this idea of recognizing race and and spending money or setting priorities according to race. Many of the Republican representatives in Lansing say that is racism. It's not different from treating somebody differently because of the color of their skin. Answer that. Tell us why that's not the, the right way to think of it, that if we were just colorblind about all of these things, everything would be okay.
Well, things aren't okay. And we have a history, whether we're talking about redlining, we're talking about who benefited from the GI Bill, who benefited from access to capital. Those are generational things. And when we talk about generational wealth, it takes a significant amount of time to overcome that. And we have not done a good job of addressing income inequality and racial inequality in our country. And so if we want to do better, we need to make sure that we acknowledge race. A good example, an individual example of this is, you know, people say, well, poverty is, we're really talking about poverty. We don't need to talk about race. Well, look at Serena Williams. She has a intensely powerful story and almost died during childbirth because of her health care or health conditions, and likely was not recognized because she is a Black woman. And she has all the means and power in the world in terms of money, access, power. And so when we look at both individual examples as well as really looking at the data, it shows that there are different outcomes when you are a person of color or coming from a Black and brown community.
Yeah, race matters, and we can't pretend that it doesn't as a way of achieving progress. That was my conversation with Monique Stanton, president and CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy, about Governor Gretchen Whitmer's budget proposal. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Welcome back to Created Equal on 101.9 WDET in Detroit. Let's take a listen now to a conversation I had with Malik Yakini, one of the founders behind the Detroit People's Food Co-op, which will open soon and offer better, fresher food options for people in the city of Detroit. I do want to talk about this change that happened in city government in Detroit recently. We now have someone who's in charge of food access and security. Tapfira Rushton is her name. I'm sure you know her, of course. We had her on the program after she took that job and had a really interesting conversation about what she thinks is the power of city government to play a role in expanding food access. But I wonder, as someone who's worked in this space for such a long time, what your reaction is to city government getting involved. You know, the people always joke about someone showing up and saying, "I'm from the government. I'm here to help." And we don't always find it to be that way. So I'm curious how you're receiving this.
Well, first, I think it's a tremendous step forward that Detroit has appointed its first director of urban agriculture. This is something that our organization and many others have been advocating for well over a decade. And so we're glad that that move has finally been taken. I want to be clear, though, that the urban agriculture movement in the city of Detroit and the movement for food justice and food sovereignty is being led on a grassroots level. Mm-hmm. And the city government is coming along, sometimes kicking and screaming. they're beginning, I think, to see more how urban agriculture fits into the redevelopment of the city. But I want to be clear that the leadership of this has started on the grassroots level. And to the extent that we have politicians supporting it, it's because of the long-term relentless work of people on the ground. So Tefera is one of those persons who has been...
Right. They reached out to the grassroots part of this movement.
Well,
right?
You know, Tefera was the founder of the Detroit Black Farmer Land Fund, the initiator of that. And in that capacity was negotiating with the city on the behalf of several farmers to purchase land. And so because of her interactions with the city, she got a chance to see how the city government works, and they got a chance to see how she works, and they respected her, and she was offered that position. So we think it's a tremendous step forward. I would say, though, that I'm always concerned when we have a singular city department. We have a director of urban agriculture, but no other staff persons. And so we want to make sure that going forward, that there is an adequate budget allocated for that office, that there is adequate staffing so that Tefera can do the work that needs to be done to break down the great inequity that we see in the city of Detroit and to empower the majority population to have access to land to build greater food sovereignty.
Yeah. If you could think of one or two things that city government could be most helpful with in terms of food access and distribution and ownership, which I think you can't have the conversation without talking about ownership. What would be on that list?
Well, a couple things. One, you know, water is a huge issue. Now, the city proper doesn't control the water system, but it's still, you know, it's kind of related to city government. I'll say that. And one of the problems that local farmers are having is that we're charged the same rate that someone is charged for a home water bill. And in Detroit, a large portion of the water bill is actually for sewerage. I think it's something like 75% of your water bill is actually for sewerage. And so the water department makes the assumption that, let's say, if 500 cubic feet of water come through the meter, that you're also putting 500 cubic feet of water back into the city's stormwater management system.
Yeah.
That logic holds if you're a homeowner and you're flushing the toilet and water is going back in the sewers. But if you are a farmer, and a farm is a permeable surface and you're absorbing the water, actually what you're doing is you're diverting water from the stormwater management system. And so we need some water rates that recognize the contribution that agriculture is making to not overloading the stormwater management system. The second thing that we would like to see, of course, is a more easy and a more consistent road to land ownership for agriculture. And certainly the work of Tefera and others have started moving things in that direction, but we still see some inconsistency depending on who you talk to from the city about purchasing land. You may get a different answer on a different day if you have depending on the person you're talking to. And so we want to see clear policies that are transparent and apply equally across the board. And then the final thing I would say is that as we're looking at increasing grocery store or shelf space in the city of Detroit, the city of Detroit can actually incentivize grocery stores and other food-related businesses, and particularly co-ops that are owned by community members, could actually incentivize those so that we see an intentional effort to build these community-owned grocery stores in the city of Detroit so that community members have ownership and a stake and are not just the consumers at the end of a complex process.
Yeah, you and I have had conversations before about the land question that you're raising and who owns land in the city of Detroit and how hard it is for so many people who would like to own land or more land to get it right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, land, I mean, this is, the United States was founded largely because, you know, people from Western Europe were coming here looking for land that they could have access to. So this issue of land ownership is a continuing issue that plagues American society and that continues to create great inequality and great inequity between those who so-called own the land and those who don't have access to land ownership.
Yeah. You've had a long journey at the People's Food Co-op. I mean, this has been, I want to say,
2010.
Right. It's more than 10 years.
Yeah.
You're going to open in February 2024, but talk about...
At this point, we're projecting April.
April? And okay.
There's been a few problems, things dealing with DTE and a few, you know, contractual issues, but we're 99% complete with the building. Yeah.
But talk about that journey from 2010 to now. That's a long time to work to try to get something so vital to the community opened.
Yeah, well, I'll just say first that if we want to build things, we have to be committed to the long term. Most things that are of value are not built instantly. And so we have to have like this longevity to really get these things done. So I want to really stress that for people who are considering building grocery stores or any other kind of community institution. Secondly, I'll say that, you know, racism is built into American capitalism. And I'll start by one of the basic tools that is used by financiers to decide whether or not they're going to finance a project, and that's what's called a market study. And so market studies are fraught with all kind of notions about what a city like Detroit is like. For example, when the Detroit Whole Foods store opened in 2013, the market study had certain sales projections. And as it turned out,
they were all wrong.
Yeah, they were all wrong. The store blew those projections out of the water, and per square foot, that is now the best performing store in the Whole Foods chain. And so there are certain assumptions about Detroit that aren't captured in these market studies. For example, there are many people in what we call the shadow economy in Detroit, people maybe who are doing hair in their house or who are baking cakes or making meals on the weekend. There's all kinds of things that people are doing to make money, some of which are sanctioned by the state and some of which are not sanctioned by the state. But nonetheless, that's an important part of the economy. And so if you do a market study and you don't take that into account, then your results are going to be skewed. And there's many other ways in which market studies are skewed. And that's one of the first steps that creates discrimination and who gets financing and who doesn't. So, we were on a very long journey to raise this $21.6 million. I will say that one of the things that worked in our favor, frankly, is in 2020, both the pandemic and the police murder of George Floyd shifted people's consciousness in terms of financing, funding, and that many more funders were interested in creating streams of funding that went to create racial justice. And so we were in some ways perfectly positioned at the right time. We already had all our I's dotted, T's crossed. We were in a position that we were able to accept that funding, and we've been able to move forward with the project.
Yeah, $21 million, that's a big number, but...
Relative, you know, it's all relative, right. You know, and had you said $21 million to me 10 years ago, I would have said, yeah, that's a huge number. But now, for me, the veil has been kind of pulled back, and
on
a certain level, it's not really a huge project, right? And so part of what we have to do in our community in order to accomplish big things is think on a larger level.
Yeah. Okay. Malik Yakini, it's always great to have you here.
We got
to
tell people how they can join the co-op.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? So that's the most important thing. People can be member owners of the Detroit People's Food Co-op by going to our website, which is www.DetroitPeoplesFoodCoop.com. Again, that's www.DetroitPeoplesFoodCoop.com. peoplesfoodcoop.com. We currently have 2,136 member owners. We would love to have you. We'd love to bump those numbers up to at least 3,000.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm joining very soon, and I will be shopping there because, again, this is right around the corner from my house. April 2024, cannot wait.
We can't wait for
this to open.
And we got all kind of jobs opening, too. We need to say that. People need to stay in touch with us because we're currently hiring for managers in the store in February. So we'll be hiring for the rest of the staff. So we're going to create about 40 new jobs. So stay tuned.
Excellent. Okay, so another great week of shows here on Created Equal. Really diverse subjects and taking us to some places other than Detroit to think about inequality with Luke Schaefer and his book, Injustice of Place.
Yeah, I'm thinking rural poverty, governor's budget, a little politics in there. Then we've got food and co-ops and community organizing. Yeah, I, like that. I like that diversity.
It's a nice mix.
It's a nice mix. Yeah. I appreciate it. I think for me, my the conversation you had with Malik Yakini also stood out for me as well. I think I'm going to give a quick shout out to my father because he's also someone who's really passionate about the food ecosystem here in Detroit.
Is that right?
Yeah. He's really passionate about it. So it kind of rubbed off on me as well. So whenever I think about, like, if I had one thing I would do that's like a foundational investment in, like, our community, it would be, you know, trying to figure out how to get a grocery store that's providing healthier foods.
Yeah, it's a builder.
Shout out to Luke and Monique as well. We didn't
absolutely,
get to them, but
absolutely.
Thank them for coming on.
They were,
those
they were
great
wonderful
well.
Guests. Great conversations. That'll do it for us here on Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org and make sure you subscribe to our podcast. You can also leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Our audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.